This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
I'm Deborah Bell.
J.D. Doyle.
Glenn Holt.
Elisar Saliba.
And tonight on our show, even though it's a cold night here in Montrose.
It's winter.
It is winter.
The beautiful full moon. I don't care how many Christmas decorations are out.
Did you howl at the moon?
Yeah, of course.
I did too. Did you, Jack? No, I didn't. Not yet. I was howling at Deborah.
Oh,
on tonight
was a full moon. Then
that was a full moon. I feel some love.
On tonight's show, David Elliott joins us from Washington, D.C. with the Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. We talk to members of the Gay Men's Chorus and the Bayou Women's City Bayou Women's Chorus about their holiday concerts. I will be talking to the long-time GLBT activist Ray Hill. All that, plus the internationally syndicated program This Way Out, calendar commentary, news brief chats, and music, and more. All of that on tonight's show. And before we talk to David, and this time we won't hang up on him, because, you know, if the election went the other way, I'd probably hang up on him.
Well, he's bound to get it right sometime.
Well, he has quite a bit to talk about tonight, because there is a change a-coming that's been in the works for a while, and aren't we glad?
Aren't we glad, and we need a change after what's going on. Well, of course, we had some cold weather, but we're heading into that holiday season and holiday parties, and
it'll probably be in the high 80s during Christmas.
I hope so.
Me too.
Yes. Be easier to get the tree then.
Went to a lovely holiday party for the lesbians over age 50 out at a place in Conroe.
I didn't get my invitation.
You're not 50 yet.
Yeah, really. That's only because you're not 50 yet. But they had a horse-driven carriage with the jingle bells on it.
Wow.
And it was really nice. We snuggled up under blankets and had a little ride out in the country.
Ooh.
So I think David is with us, and we'll get him on the line and start talking.
Good evening, David.
Uh-oh. The light went out.
Oh, dear. Well, it wasn't David. It was the spooks calling.
Ooh, the spooks are calling again.
You know, because our lines are tapped.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They could just listen over the air. They got to tap the phone lines.
Yeah. See, we have a message. It says he is not called yet. Okay. Hot news. This could, just in.
We could just.
David Elliott has not called in, but I do
the
see
line. The, someone's calling in.
So let's see what we can do with this now. We are so professional here on Queer Voices. David, are you there? Hello, Earth to David.
There.
Hey,
hi, David.
Yes, welcome.
Well, how are you all?
We're just lovely, and yourself?
I am doing just great.
We are so happy since
sure
November.
So what's going on in Washington and outside the Beltway?
Well, you know what? In the aftermath of the November midterm elections, I have four words for you only. How sweet it is.
Yes.
Okay. I lied. I actually have more than four words. I'd like to review...
Because you wouldn't be the David Elliott we know and love if you did.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I'd really like to review with you what happened on November 7th. And then I'd like to briefly consider perhaps four trends to consider when we look at the recent election results and beyond.
Okay.
Now, by now, most of your listeners know that Democrats captured the House and the Senate, that is the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. The pickup in the House was approximately 30 seats, or about 15 seats more than were necessary for us to achieve a governing majority. In the Senate, the pickup was six seats, the exact number needed to achieve a 51-seat majority for the Democrats. And among those elected to the Senate were Claire McCaskill of Missouri and Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, bringing the total number of women serving in the U.S. Senate to 16, which is the highest number ever.
Woo-hoo!
And that's worth pointing out. Yeah.
One for our side, Jennifer.
It's not what it should be, but we're making progress. Now, that's what happened in Congress. But I ask you, my friends, what happened in the states?
What happened?
Well, Democrats won strongly at the state level as well. Going into this election, Republicans controlled governors' mansions in 28 states, and Democrats controlled governors' mansions in 22 states. That number totally reversed itself on Election Day, with Democrats now controlling 28 states and Republicans 22.
Although, unfortunately, not in Texas.
Well, yes, right. Democrats picked up governor's mansions in six states, the Democratic-leaning states of Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York, and the swing states of Arkansas, Colorado, and Ohio. By another calculation critical to the party's success in 2008, Democratic governors will now control states with 295 electoral votes. And, of course, it takes 270 to win the presidency. Now, Democrats also enjoyed incredible success at the state legislative level, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because for approximately one decade, Democrats and Republicans have been pretty equal in terms of, the number of state legislative chambers that each party held, as well as the number of actual legislative seats. No longer. This past election, on November 7th, Democrats captured the following legislative chambers: the Iowa House and Senate, the Indiana House, the Minnesota House, the Michigan House, the New Hampshire House and Senate, the Oregon House, the Pennsylvania House, and the Wisconsin Senate. Now, there are four trends that I would like to briefly discuss that we should really look at and follow when we're analyzing the 2006 election results, and really beyond.
David, it seems like we no longer just have red and blue states, but some states are now becoming our favorite color, purple.
Well, some states are becoming purple. Some purple states are becoming blue. But really, there's a whole lot of purple in there, Deborah. That's the honest truth.
Yay!
But, you know, there are a couple of things that I want to point out about the recent elections. Four trends, if I may. First, it's worth pointing out that not a single prominent Democrat incumbent lost on Election Day. Not one Democratic senator lost. Not one Democratic House member lost. Not a single Democratic governor lost. This reinforces our prediction, which we made early and often on this very program, that this would indeed be a wave election, with Democrats sweeping to victory at every level. Second, the 2006 election was not an isolated event, but rather part of a continuum that began in 2004. What do I mean by that? Remember what happened in 2004. A Democratic nominee for president who could barely tie his shoelaces, much less, you know, articulate an effective message to the American people, came within one state of winning the White House. When one considers how the battles over message framing will play out over the next 2 years, it is really clearly evident that Democrats will enter the 2008 campaign environment with opportunities to expand their margins in both the U.S. House and Senate, and that they will at least be competitive in the battle for the White House.
Well, David, I you know, it's really interesting, your premise, and I hope you're right. But I think there's a couple things to sort of argue the other way. So many of the House seats are rigged to stay into one party, and the majority of them are Republicans. Number two, I think on your side, though, the president still continues to screw up even more, which is probably going to help the Democrats out.
Well, Bill, Jack, let me make this argument to you.
Okay,
you're completely right about the electoral battle in terms of the U.S. House being rigged for the Republicans, or more accurately, for incumbents.
Yes, yes.
We actually came close to a 50-seat pickup this time around. We picked up 30 seats of 10 seats that we lost. There were 10 races where the Democratic challenger to the Republican incumbent, or it was an open seat with a Democratic candidate challenging. That candidate lost by fewer than 3,000 votes. This little wave that I've talked about, where we picked up 30 seats in the House, it could have definitely been a lot larger if, you know, we had just had 1 or 2 percentage points go our way a little bit more. Now, let me just go on a little bit more with a couple of trends that we could look at from the 2006 elections. One trend we can definitely look at is that it is now evident that the American West has become the new Florida and Ohio.
Yes.
Now, what do I mean by this? Well, for the past two presidential election cycles, Florida and Ohio have really controlled who won the White House. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 2000, if all of the eligible voters had been allowed to cast ballots, and if all of the votes had been counted accurately, then Gore would have won the state of Ohio, and thus he would have won the presidency. And in both 2000 and 2004, had the Democratic presidential nominee won either Florida or Ohio, the Democrats would have won the White House. Now, over the course of the next half generation, Florida and Ohio will not necessarily play such a pivotal role. Instead, we're going to see such western states as Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and even Montana control the center. Whichever party wins the majority of these states will ultimately control the White House and perhaps even Congress for the next half generation. And finally, I have one final trend I want to share with you. The 2008 presidential race has already begun.
Yes.
However, due to the incredibly and obnoxiously high cost of running for president, what is now considered a wide open field will, by early 2008, just 13 or 14 months from now, shrink to only maybe 4 or so candidates. On the Republican side, I firmly believe that the only 2 candidates left standing will be Arizona Senator John McCain and outgoing Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who is really well skilled at message development and who is building a formidable campaign team. And on the Democratic side, things are a little bit more wide open, and everything seems to depend on whether Illinois freshman Senator Barack Obama will run.
Yeah.
If he runs, it will be a battle of the titans between Obama and Hillary Clinton. If Obama does not run, or for that matter, if Hillary does not run, then I think we will need to seriously consider the prospects of 4 other candidates: former Senator John Edwards, retired General Wesley Clark, former Vice President Al Gore, and outgoing Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack. And Deb and Jack, that's the update from Washington, D.C., where the current temperature is now below freezing, but where we have a very sunny post-election disposition.
Right, but of course now the Democrats have to govern. And we've seen that, you know, even in the majority, the Republicans could not govern. They couldn't pass a spending bill. They spent more money when they did spend money than they should have. And I'm a liberal.
And they didn't fund their very own mandate.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And it seemed like Bush especially kept making promises about, oh, this much money is going to go to AIDS and this much money is going to go for this. And, of course, we know it really all is going for a war that shouldn't exist. And how about that, David, on the home front right now? Because it seems like the sentiment each day grows more and more, stop the war now, bring our troops home, let the Iraqis have whatever government they want. We can't force them to have a democracy.
Well, Deborah, two things. First, if you look at the exit polling data, there are two reasons why the elections went the way they went. First and foremost, voters were concerned about corruption in Washington, D.C.
Rightfully so.
Second, they were concerned about Iraq.
Rightfully so.
And so the Democrats are going to have to embrace and engage on those issues. The other thing that you have to look at is if you look at the different income classes and how people voted on November 7th, Democrats won every single income class except for people who earned the income level of $100,000 plus.
That would not be me.
Now, mm-hmm. That would not be me either, and I imagine it would not be Jack as well. And frankly, maybe I'm overgeneralizing.
Glenn,
here,
maybe.
But I'm guessing it wouldn't, it wouldn't affect the majority of people listening to this program
right.
tonight. And so then you have to look at what the Democrats' agenda is going to be in early January. Well, first, they're looking at passing an increase in the minimum wage.
Very good.
Second, they're looking at lowering the student loan rate for college student loans so that more middle-class families can send their kids to college and not go bankrupt as a result.
Excellent.
Third, they're looking at making prescription drugs more affordable.
Oh, yay.
And fourth, they're looking at legislation to clean up the corruption, clean up the mess.
Well, and I hope they really do a good job in that area and don't let this opportunity slip them by.
Well, and, you know, I'm very, very optimistic. And if you look at that four-pronged, four-tier early January legislative agenda that the Democrats are looking at pursuing once they come into power on January 3rd, 2007, I think you're looking at issues that appeal to the middle class. And quite frankly, you know, I don't want to leave out, I don't want to engage in what the other side calls class warfare here. I don't want to leave out anybody. But frankly, if you engage issues that are important to the middle class, working families, working American families, then you're going to control the center of the political spectrum. And if you control the center of the political spectrum, you control the American politic.
Very good, David. And David, you work for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. In what position?
I am their communications director, and you can look at our website at www.ncadp.org. Again, that's ncadp.org.
And then, don't you also have a blog?
Yes, we do. It is www.deathpenaltyusa.blogspot.com. Again, that's deathpenaltyusa.blogspot.com.
Thank you, David, for being with us on Queer Voices. David Elliott joins us the first Monday of every month for his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report.
Thank you all for having me.
Thank you. I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the 2 weeks ending December 2nd, 2006. Two men celebrated South Africa's first same-gender wedding in the southern Cape town of George on December 1st, the day the new Civil Union Act allowing gay and lesbian couples to legally unite took effect. Vernon Gibbs and Tony Halls have been together for 9 years and combined their surnames following the ceremony. Vernon Halls Gibbs said it was significant that their union took place on World AIDS Day. This marriage is for all HIV/AIDS sufferers and gay people who have experienced discrimination, he said. I just have one message I would like to give to everybody, that we are just two men who love each other and who have loved each other for a long time. His new husband, Tony, said of their union that it gives us as a couple a lot more security when it comes to pension, property, and bank accounts. The couple runs a guest lodge and animal rehabilitation center, which was attacked last year after it became known that it was being marketed to gay tourists. The Halls Gibbs wore matching Game Ranger outfits at their wedding ceremony. The Civil Union Act was signed into law on November 30th, just a day before the December 1st deadline set by last year's South African Constitutional Court ruling that said marriage discrimination against same-gender couples was unconstitutional. That ruling, which ordered Parliament to fix the inequity by December 1st, was based on South Africa's first-in-the-world constitutional ban on sexual orientation discrimination.
Most other South African same-gender couples, however, will probably have to wait until next year before they can legally tie the knot. Only Home Affairs marriage officers are currently able to officiate at civil ceremonies under the new Civil Union Act, while religious marriage officers have to first undergo examinations on the new act, a process which could take weeks to implement. Vernon and Tony Halls Gibbs were only able to marry because the Home Affairs Registry office they traveled to, in George, had no other bookings. But registry offices across the rest of the country report that they're booked solid with heterosexual weddings. The soonest gay and lesbian ceremonies can take place in most areas will be January, and couples in Cape Town, Wynberg, Belleville, and Nyanga may have to wait until March. Angry queer activists are saying that Home Affairs, which was on record against it, failed to prepare for the new law that everyone knew was coming. The Civil Union Act also allows civil registry officials who object to same-gender weddings on moral grounds to refuse to perform them. Some legal experts believe that provision of the Act may be unconstitutional. The Roman Catholic Church and several conservative Protestant denominations fought the civil union legislation and will also not perform same-gender weddings.
Even though South Africa has become the first on the continent to legally recognize same-gender couples, other uncertainties remain. The country's Human Rights Commission and some LGBT rights advocates have warned that civil unions may not satisfy the Constitutional Court's mandate for marriage equality. South Africa's Marriage Act remains unchanged, although a government spokesperson has said changes will eventually be made to incorporate gay and lesbian couples. The separate Civil Union Act says nothing about gender, but establishes the voluntary union of two persons, which is solemnized and registered by either a marriage or civil union.
In a separate case, South Africa's Constitutional Court ruled on November 23rd that gays and lesbians should be able to inherit the property of their partners who die without a will. The High Court said the country's Intestate Succession Act discriminated against same-gender couples, and that whenever the word spouse is mentioned in that law, the words "or partner in a permanent same-sex life partnership in which the partners have undertaken reciprocal duties of support" should be added.
Israel's High Court of Justice ruled 6-1 on November 21st that same-gender couples who marry in places where it's legal must be considered legally married in Israel. The case was brought by five Israeli couples who married in Canada. Supported by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, they appealed to the country's top court after authorities refused to recognize their Canadian unions after they came home. The court ordered the Interior Ministry to recognize the five couples as married. The court emphasized, however, that its decision was not a recognition of same-gender marriage. Israel's religious authorities control the country's marriage and divorce laws, and the court stressed that only Parliament could change that situation. The High Court decision was nevertheless denounced by religious conservatives as an abomination. "We don't have a Jewish state here," said Moshe Gafni, an ultra-Orthodox lawmaker. "We have Sodom and Gomorrah here." He called the ruling the destruction of the family unit in the state of Israel. Gaffney said he might offer a bill in parliament to overturn the court ruling and make recognition of all same-gender marriages in Israel illegal.
A Moscow appeals court this week upheld a lower court ruling that said the city government acted legally when it banned an LGBT pride parade in May. The Moscow Central Prefecture Court agreed with the lower court that the city had the right to prohibit events based on security concerns. Because of the ban, this year's first ever march was downsized to an attempt by LGBT activists to lay flowers at the tomb of the unknown soldier, then walk a few blocks to a rally across from City Hall. The participants were violently attacked by neo-fascists, skinheads, and fundamentalist Christians. Riot police were slow to move in, and most of the 200 people detained were LGBT people and their supporters. Moscow Mayor Yuri Yushkov called the attempt to lay flowers at the tomb of the unknown soldier a desecration, a provocation, and a contamination. People burst through, and of course they beat them up, he said. Dmitry Bitunyev, an attorney for two LGBT groups that had filed the appeal, said he will take the issue to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg.
The new chair of Latvia's Human Rights and Social Affairs Committee is a parliamentarian who's called gays and lesbians degenerates and perverts. Jānis Smits, a leading member of the ultra-right Latvia First Party, was elected to the post by parliament in what is seen as retaliation against President Vēra Vaika Freiburga for her support of LGBT rights. Mindful that Latvia's European Union membership requires laws banning sexual orientation discrimination, she had earlier this year essentially forced Latvia's parliament to enact such legislation. The European Parliament's Intergroup on Gay and Lesbian Rights said it deplores the selection of Smits as the country's human rights chair, noting that he frequently quotes the Old Testament in defense of his old-fashioned values, arguing in favor of a worldview that advocates sexual minorities should be put to death. Terry Davis, the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, also issued a statement condemning the selection, saying that the parliamentarians who made this decision should realize that what is at stake is the international reputation of Latvia.
The socially conservative island nation of Grenada has rejected a recommendation from a regional United Nations office to decriminalize homosexuality and prostitution. Health Minister Anne David Antoine said her government would not consider legal reforms advised in a report by the United Nations Development Program after a September conference in Barbados on combating HIV/AIDS. Every sovereign country has to take on board its own cultural situation, the faith and religious situation within the country, she told reporters after announcing the government would not consider any changes to its laws.
Lesbian gay rights advocates in the Australian island state of Tasmania have written to Tas-born Crown Princess Mary of Denmark, asking her to point out the benefits to her childhood home that have come from its greater acceptance of gays and lesbians. The letter is a direct response to recent media reports of anti-queer harassment and the absence of anti-discrimination laws in the Danish-administered semi-autonomous Faroe Islands. Tasmanian gay and lesbian rights group spokesperson Rodney Kroom said that his state has an important lesson to teach the Faroes and other island communities about the benefits of accepting diversity. Kroom said it would be inappropriate for Princess Mary, as the future queen of a constitutional monarchy, to speak publicly about political matters, but added that she has every right to talk about how Tasmania has changed for the better in the past several years, after long being known for its harsh anti-queer laws and attitudes. I'm sure no one would resent Princess Mary gently and graciously pointing out lessons from her homeland that may benefit some of her future subjects, said Kroom. A word in the right ear at the right time could make all the difference.
And finally, Sir Elton John was performing in Australia this week and had two less than gentle words for that country's Conservative Prime Minister, John Howard. The pop star and his partner, David Furnish, last December became one of the first queer couples in England to tie the knot in a civil partnership ceremony. It was just a commitment I wanted to make because I love him, and vice versa, and it was just a great day, Sir Elton told the Seven Television Network. The Howard government overturned a civil unions law earlier this year in the Australian Capital Territory, but the PM insisted that his government was not anti-homosexual. It is not a question of discriminating against them, he said. It is a question of preserving, as an institution in our society, marriage as having a special character, and that the ACT civil unions law would have been treated for all purposes as being equivalent to a marriage. Asked what he would like to say to Howard about the PM's views on same-gender unions, Sir Elton simply replied, "Up yours."
That's News Wrap for the 2 weeks ending December 2nd, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Wasn't that good? This is J.D. Doyle.
And Jennifer Renee.
And we just heard the Bayou City Performing Arts, and we heard, I guess that was the women's part of it, and there's a reason we heard that. We've got two of their representatives here right now, Colleen Fisher and Kelly Bennett. Welcome to Queer Voices.
Thank you very much.
Hi, thanks.
And, okay, there's got to be a timeliness reason why you're here tonight.
There's always a timeliness reason to why we're anywhere. The next several nights, Tuesday and Thursday, the women are performing their holiday concerts Coming Home at Baring Memorial United Methodist Church over here in the Montrose area. And so we're here promoting those and trying to drum up some extra ticket sales. It's a fabulous concert. We had a standing ovation on Saturday night. We're very proud of them.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And we've just released a new CD, which you were just listening to, called A New Season Live, and it features both the men and the women of the Bayou City Performing Arts. And it's just a great representation of our entire choral family at Bayou City. So we're very proud of it. It has 6 tracks from the women, 10 tracks from the men. It has one fabulous joint track that is featured. It's the last track on the CD.
There must be a lot of people on stage.
Yeah, there is, especially when you get about 90 of the men, and for this concert in particular, there was 25 women. So, 115 people, and that number just keeps going up. By the time they do the show for the men's concert on December 19th at Jones Hall, we'll have about 150 people on stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot of coordination.
Yeah, it is. James does an amazing job. Yeah. James Knapp is our artistic director.
That'll be a powerful sound.
Yeah, it will be. And we're doing some really beautiful pieces that should bring people just, they're extremely moving. And so we think that the close of the show is going to be the real topper of the entire evening.
All the music seasonal for this time of the season, or are you going to do anything else?
Well, there's always a few pieces that could be questionable, but for the most part, we do just try to celebrate the holidays and bring as many of the traditions to
I'm
the
sure
table as we can.
Some humor thrown in.
Oh, always.
Can you
always
tell us about that a little bit?
Actually, one of the pieces we're doing is called I Want to Be a Rockette, which the gentleman will be doing.
Of course,
it'll be accompanied by tons of hysterical dancing, and Albert Gambo is doing the choreography for that, and he's also one of our singers, and he does an amazing job, so I'm sure that'll be hysterical.
So a chorus with a choreographer.
Yes, amongst several other things, but
sounds definitely like a paradox of some kind.
I'm sure it is. Gosh, other funny pieces that the men are doing on the 19th.
There's the conga.
They are. The close of the show is the Christmas conga, and you just you can't. I mean, you're definitely going to want to get out of your seat and dance around a little bit.
Are they going to have the audience sing alongs like they have in the
past? Yes. Yep, that has become a traditional part of our holiday concerts, and we're excited to have them. So this year won't be any exception.
Which song is that going to be?
If I'm remembering correctly, I finished the program
the
notes
women
today.
The women got to do Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which was a lot of fun. So
yeah, and Deck the Halls.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the men are doing Joy to the World. And we wish you a Merry Christmas.
Stuff people know.
Yeah. But we always include the lyrics, so make it easy for everyone.
Now, I'm holding a CD in my hand. This has some material on it that people may not know. How did you pick the material for this?
Gosh, that's a great question for James. But I'm going to do the best I can.
He's not here.
Exactly. He's at rehearsal right now. That's why I'm here.
Pure brilliance. That's
exactly.
Pure brilliance.
He's shifty. He didn't want to be. No, the songs all kind of stem from different things. We have a lot of members of the chorus who are of Hebrew and Jewish faith, so we always try to have a couple Hanukkah songs thrown in. And on the CD, there's one song that I particularly enjoy. It's called Not in Our Town, and it's a song of Hanukkah. And it just talks about this small town where, you know, anti-Semites destroyed someone's house, and it talks about the children and how you celebrate, how an entire town rallied around the folks of the Jewish faith, and they all celebrated Hanukkah that year with menorahs and things. And so there's different songs like that. And then, of course, there's always the comedy bits. On the CD, we have Coming Out at Christmas, which is just a fabulous number set to Deck the Halls and sure to entertain anyone.
And it's about coming out at Christmas.
Exactly. You know, it has, you know, there's no hidden agenda with that song. And then, you know, there's always the other numbers, the classic ones, like Home for the Holidays, Winter Wonderland.
Ave Maria.
Exactly, Ave Maria. Mm-hmm.
I like the variety, especially on the CD. So many gay chorus CDs, lesbian chorus CDs, it's the same material.
Mm-hmm.
And interchangeable. And this has a lot of, you know, it has some standards, but it has a lot of other things, too, that, you know, would be refreshing to hear. How Can I Keep from Singing? That must be beautiful, that the version of that.
Yeah, and the women performed that in their debut concert, their solo debut concert in June, and it was just, it moves people. It's especially indicative of being in the chorus and how you feel about it. And Kelly might be able to speak to that a little bit more as well, because she's singing in the women's chorus this year. So just why do you go? Why are you there? It's about, you know, the family and who we are and the community. And so it speaks to a lot of different things.
Was there any song on here that surprised you?
You know, I'd have to look at the back of it again. Let me see it first. I can't think off the top of my head.
If you want to get in touch with the chorus, how would we do that?
Well, there's a couple different ways. Easiest way is to just call us. And
what's that number?
Phone number 713-521-7464. Or there's always a website, which is www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org. Or
and you can buy the CD and tickets at the website. So
that's you can. No,
exactly. You can get everything online.
Great.
So we'll be putting the new CD on there within the week. So you'll be able to buy that on there as well. And then we're always available. We're usually out in the community. The men just sang at World AIDS Day at City Hall on Friday. We try to be out in the community. The guys were doing bar crawls this weekend and trying to drum up some ticket sales and some excitement for the shows. And there's always, we're Monday and Tuesday nights, we rehearse at Covenant Church over in the Museum District over on Caroline Street. And so there's always people there. There's always representatives there. And it's great because you can come in, you can say hi, you can ask us questions. So Monday and Tuesday nights, it's a great place to find us. But call, visit the website. Our office is on Garrett Street, just around the corner.
In January, we have open enrollment for any ladies who do see the concert who are interested in singing. So,
do you audition, or how's that done?
We try to bring you in and see if you were interested and if you're excited about it, and we try to give everybody a fair shot.
So. There's no auditions required. All you need to do is just come in the door and have an excitement.
Read music.
No,
carrying
a tune is helpful.
Important.
But and we know that there's always people out there like, I can't sing. I don't think I can do this. And let James be the judge of that. It's amazing when you get a whole entire room full of people singing together.
You had the support to take you along.
Exactly. Exactly.
When was the women's chorus founded?
Actually, it just started. The women premiered for the first time during the men's holiday concert last year, so it's just been a year now.
You've come a long way fast.
Yeah.
Obviously listening to you, yes.
Yeah, and all that credit gets to go to James and the staff and the board of directors. I mean, they worked really hard. The board of directors was really passionate about bringing the women out and making sure that they had a seat at the Bayou City Performing Arts table and being a part of the group. So we try to include so many different people and hit so many different aspects that they have an all-inclusive women's choir. Straight, gay, doesn't matter who you are, as long as you love to sing and you just love
trans. Singing.
Anyone.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Just checking.
No, it's important. And that's part of our mission statement. And it's, being a strong pillar in the community for anyone in the GLBT community.
Now, the men's chorus is how old?
28. It's our 28th season.
Wow. Oh
yeah, Montrose
God.
Singer started 28 years ago. And we're getting really excited. We're starting to gear up for like a 30th anniversary season, and we just can't believe it. We're all really excited. So,
y'all part of GALA, I guess.
Yes, definitely. The Gay and Lesbian Association choruses, mm-hmm. Yes.
So what's the big plan for next year?
Next year, there's a couple different things we've got going on. First is we're planning a fundraiser concert called Sing for the Cure with the Komen Foundation, which we're really excited about.
That's great.
Yeah. So we're trying to drum up a lot of extra women singers because it's a piece that covers the journey of 8 different women's lives as they go through breast cancer, from discovery to chemo and denial and all those different steps and stages that women go through. We're looking into different narrators and guest talent and star talent that we'd like to bring in.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, we're going to do that in conjunction. It's a third-party fundraising event for Komen, so they won't be directly related, but they will receive every single dollar and every proceed from the show will go to them directly.
So how many performances a year do you think?
For us right now, we're at 5 concert cycles, or 5 different concerts for the year.
That's quite a bit, really.
Yeah, 2 for the women and 3 for the men. And then as the women's chorus gets stronger and, we look at branching out and spreading out a little bit, that may grow. But for right now, we're just trying to stay the course and keep things growing and keep them strong.
Think, well, the next one's not for 3 months. Well, it takes all that time to organize it.
We started rehearsing the first Tuesday and then the following Monday of September to get ready for the holiday shows, and it was still tight. There's still a lot of kinks being worked out right before the show.
And you rehearse how much each week?
3 hours.
3 hours?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then
two different days, or?
7 to 10 on Tuesdays.
On Tuesdays.
And for the women. Yeah.
For the women, and then 7 to 10 on Mondays for the men. And some Sundays there's extra rehearsals to prepare right around concert time.
And a lot of us get together. It's also very social, so you get to meet a lot of new people and make a lot of new friends. Well,
I
can't participate in that.
Yeah, no, she can't. And Kelly's also my partner. So.
I'm a good girl. Yeah, no, it's a whole lot of fun, and you get to meet a whole lot more of the community, and all kind of come together for the same cause, and it's I have to say it's one of my favorite parts of the week. So,
okay, well, let's go over the who, what, and when. It's the Bayou City Performing Arts, yes. The men and the women. And when's the concert?
Ladies' concerts are this Tuesday and Thursday at 7:30 at Baring Memorial United Methodist Church on Harold Street in Montrose. And the men's concert is December 19th, 7:30 at Jones Hall, and that'll be a single night performance only.
And they can get information where?
You can call our office at 713-521-7464 or visit the website at www.BayouCityPerformingArts.org.
I'm going to let you introduce the song to come out of here. It's the last track on the CD.
Yes, we've had so many different people ask about this number. This was if anyone went to the concert, it was the last piece of the show, and it was Peace, Peace, Silent Night, and Silent Night was performed with White Gloves and Black Light in sign language. And this was a piece by both the men and the women together. So I guess we're leading out with Peace, Peace, Silent Night.
And you're listening to Career Voices.
Watch now, let the fun begin. cradle, spin, spin, spin. Run, gimel, hey, shin. Watch now, let the fun begin. Run, gimel, hey, shin. Spin the cradle, try to win. And sing along our dreidel song with me.
J.D. Doyle. I'm glad to have some Hanukkah music to add to our repertoire this year. That was Debbie Friedman with the dreidel song from her CD from 2003 called Light These Lights.
This is Queer Voices.
There, big lesbian.
Hanukkah starts on December 16th this year, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of other holidays from different traditions that take place at this time.
Including Christmas.
Christmas and the solstice.
I've not found any gay Kwanzaa songs yet. I'm looking, though.
Okay.
If anyone out there knows a gay Kwanzaa song, get in touch with J.D.
A gay artist, lesbian artist, tea artist.
Well, speaking of Christmas, we'll be here Christmas Day.
That's right. Yes, and we're hoping that you'll join us that evening.
I won't.
Jennifer will be away celebrating with friends.
She'll be on assignment.
I'm going to be on assignment in Washington, D.C.
Undercover assignment.
Undercovers.
Uh-huh. That's what I was insinuating. In D.C., you're much more likely to need to be under the covers.
Well, maybe it'll snow. I haven't seen snow in a number of years.
Yeah, that's okay.
Don't need to.
Yeah, I'm pretty much over snow after being in a blizzard when I was in D.C.
Ooh.
Yeah. So what do we need to know about? I think the conference has a meeting this week.
Yes, I wanted to let you know that this Wednesday is the general meeting of the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. It meets at 3400 Montrose, Suite 207 at 7 p.m., and this month, we've got a great speaker. It's going to be Kristen Mack, who is the political writer for the Houston Chronicle. She's been around a long time, and she's going to talk about the past election, the effects that she believes it's going to have, and also give us a little bit of history about the GLBT coverage from the Chronicle.
Well, that should be very interesting.
Oh, yes, definitely. And we'll have a couple of special guests that are coming in that have already told me just to say a few words, basically come in and say thank you to the caucus for everything the caucus PAC did during the last election.
And on Thursday,
most importantly, is a fundraiser for the Houston GLBT Political Caucus PAC. Do you have the information, Jack, on where it is?
The best thing is to go onto the website, hglbtpc.org. It is at 7 p.m., and it is on West Clay at West Drew. Let's try this one more time.
Try that again.
It's one of those West.
Yes. Cancel. We're going to start it again.
209 West Drew at Taft. It's at a residence, and they're opening up their house for this fundraiser, which is basically to help build up the coffers because there's a lot of work to do in 2007.
Spent a lot of money.
It's interesting. I don't know if you saw this in the paper, but the mayor is going to be asking the legislature not to have a special election to fill Shelley's seat for city council. The election would be in May, and the term would only last until the end of the year, which is an interesting thing. I mean, he doesn't want to spend the money, but at the same time...
Now, is she an at-large?
Yes, she's
okay.
at
large. So it's not like it's a district that wouldn't be represented. Right. Well, that makes sense. And Why spend that money?
And after the election, the special election, and possibly
I don't think
runoff,
much difference with her not there.
Well, the realistic part of it, I'm sort of in favor of not having one, but it's, you know, after you have the election, then if there's a runoff, usually there is, you have a runoff, and once they're sworn in, they may, you know, sit there for 4 months, possibly. But then they've got to turn right around in November and run again.
Right.
So
we don't really need to spend that money.
Why do we need to spend $3 million
we're much better off that we don't have Shelley Sekula Gibbs on the council and not in Congress, and that that there's not a district that won't be served by a council person with her absence. So fine by me. I think we've decided it.
We voted. Save $3 million.
So tell Bill that we decided it. And
by law, there has to be an election unless the legislature decides to change the law. However, getting them to do it such early in the session before the time of all the filing and stuff is probably rather unlikely.
It's like it's something that can be, I don't know.
Does it have a retroactive aspect to it?
You mean, in other words, could it be like we just don't do it like Bush does?
just say we're going to have one and then not show up.
And don't
fund
it,
right. Well, what I'm saying is that the legislature can say for this situation, you don't have to have an election.
Yes.
Or is it like forevermore? It would be a law that would exist having to do with forevermore.
I don't know.
I'm looking
exactly
at you like you really know.
Yes. Well, it's up to the legislature to decide on that.
So if we think there should not be a special election, we should lobby the legislature and tell them we don't want a special election.
There's a lot of confusing dates involved in this, which causes a lot of problem. He has to schedule it actually almost simultaneously with the legislature going into session.
Right. And there is money that is spent that doesn't need to be spent, might be better spent elsewhere. But one good thing about it is if there is someone that gets that seat, it might help launch them. Like, I think Barbara Ann Radnofsky needs to serve in some elected office, and that will aid
give somebody
her
a foot in the door.
Right, exactly.
That's great. Well.
Anyway, that was the idea that I had, because it's a shame that we don't have her as U.S. Senator, because that is one of
that's a shame.
She's a candidate like Ellen Cohen. I mean, we need people like that.
I would imagine a lot of people would want to run, though.
That could be.
I understand that, the rumor is there's going to be a full slate.
Are you going to run?
Four or five. No.
Oh, okay.
No. I have my responsibilities here on the show.
At the women's group, somebody was saying, well, who's going to be the Democratic nominee? Who's going to be the Democratic nominee? And one of the women there.
It's a nonpartisan election.
No, I'm talking about for president. And this one woman, Mary, says, I'll do it. And so we decided that she could be the president, and we divided the cabinet positions between us at the. Hey?
All it'd take is $100 million to start off with.
Trust me, it would be a lot better world.
Couldn't be any worse.
Yeah. Oh, that's for sure.
Okay.
That's sure. So it'll be real interesting to see. But the bringing up the legislative session, that's where we're going to be having to do a lot of work.
Yes. And they go back and they go into session in early January. And, of course, the Texas Equality Texas, is it?
Equality
Texas.
Is working on, keeping us informed on what's going on in the legislature.
Well, there's two that Jessica Farr has introduced that's already in there. And one of them is House Bill 305, which is non-discrimination within our educational system.
Wonderful.
And then the other is 307, which has to do with non-discrimination in the state at large.
Yes, even though they have not taken office yet, they are filing bills. And you can go to the website, State of Texas website, and follow the trail to find the legislature. And you can find what bills are being filed and what we might need to be looking out for. And I'll
yes,
be...
what?
I will be starting my term as president of the Texas National Organization for Women.
Congratulations.
And so I will be very involved in what's going on in the legislature. We've got some wonderful candidates that are applying to be our legislative liaison. And so we'll be getting some reports that we can let our listeners know about.
And we are scheduling, I say we, the transgender community is scheduling a transgender lobby day up in Austin, possibly the latter part of January, which will be an interesting. I've been to lobbying up there a couple of times, both for the GLBT community and then the transgender community.
Well, thank you for listening to Queer Voices. Up next, Jack will be interviewing our favorite citizen provocateur, Ray Hill.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Do you remember me? I sat upon your knee. I wrote to you with childhood fantasies. Well, I'm all grown up now. Can you still help somehow? I'm not a child, but my heart still can dream. So here's my lifelong wish, my grown-up Christmas list. Not for myself, but for a world in need. No torn apart, that wars would never start, and time would heal all hearts. Every man would have a friend, that right would always win, and love would never. This is my grown-up Christmas list. What is this illusion called? The innocence of youth. Maybe only in our blind belief can we ever find the
And this is J.D. That was Russ Lawrence and brand new CD, What I Want from Christmas, and the song was My Grown-Up Christmas List.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, every so often we need to bring Ray Hill back. We
take and people the, wonder why.
Why? I
mean, they have to go by the nursing home and get out the wheelchair and...
open up the closet door.
Open up the closet door. Right. I'm in many closet doors these days.
Well, a little bit less than 25 years ago when I was walking in the door here, Ray was guarding this studio to make sure somebody didn't come on. Because back then there was no internet, of course, and there was no other options. There was no logo. Or Hear TV. This was pretty much it.
Yeah. Especially in the South.
Yes.
Actually, the real pioneer of Southern gay radio, but he never actually admitted it on the air, was Dave Lambold.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave was on a little Houston station. I was the kind of the late night music man. And he did Just Before Dawn. The darkest hour is just before dawn, as the lyric goes. And he gave all kinds of gay innuendo radio.
Wow.
By the time you got here, he had moved on to Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And he is now in San Francisco. He is the reviewer for Bar Magazine in New York, in San Francisco, which is their big gay rag. They actually have a weekly newspaper out there.
Well, we also didn't have things like satellite receivers and all that type of stuff. It was pretty interesting. And actually, strangely enough, this was the station where Morning Edition was heard on originally.
Yes, when I was manager, I put NPR on the air.
But we're not here to talk about
and BBC
that.
On the air.
Yes, yes.
I had to do BBC by shortwave and a radio up in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
And we did Morning Editions. Well, we did all of them. We did Small Things Considered, Morning Emissions, and Weakened Condition. All three NPR news programs, and we did them over telephone lines.
Yes. Well, yes. So anyway, we've come a long way, and we're just here to talk about what's up in your world, Ray.
Well, I've had a relatively busy week. Today I went to Huntsville and gave my annual Ray Hill and John Endo Goes and Talks to People in College to Work in Prisons lecture, and John's job is to inform them, and my job is to make them uncomfortable. Not always succeeded doing that.
Good for you. And,
I said, are Texans as a class so much worse than other people in the world that we have to lock up a larger percentage of them than anywhere in the world except Louisiana? Now, Louisiana, it may actually be true that people are worse than other places and may need to. But is that true of Texas as well?
Well, California's getting up there, too, I understand.
Not in percentages.
I understand they're even talking about
numbers. Actually, California is more than Texas.
Sending people outside the state because they don't have enough room inside the state.
And Texas has got spare room to rent, yeah. There's a bunch of private prisons. There are actually more Hawaiian inmates in Texas than there are in Hawaii.
Wow.
Can you imagine how expensive land is in Hawaii to be building prisons?
Are these private prisons working out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what do you mean working out? They look pretty good on stock exchange. how do they treat people? Well, actually, they're liable for more litigation than state prisons. And the private prisons in Texas are the only ones that are air-conditioned. So if you're an inmate and you got your choices, that's a pretty good thing.
But on these private prisons, isn't it more likely you'd be sent further away from your home?
Hawaii to Texas, that's just around the corner, isn't it?
Well, isn't there a disconnect when you don't have your family that there's probably a better chance that you'd be end up back in there?
Hey, you're talking about where I live. I mean, KPFT stands for Keep Prison Families Together, as far as a prison show is concerned. Texas doesn't, the state prison system, the private prisons, all have telephones and make a lot of money off of them. But the state prisons do not have telephones. And that's why the prison show is here, is because we make that connection over the radio waves. Another little piece of creative ingenuity.
Well, and you share it with the rest of the world.
Yeah. And the people have no privacy there. But I think the prison show is probably the most political thing that I have ever done, and I think I'm absolutely amazed that I'm doing it in other people's voices, especially voices of children and the elderly and the infirm.
Genius. Pure genius.
I mean, it's great radio. It's Rush Limbaugh, just eat your heart out. I know what I'm doing in radio, and he doesn't.
Yeah, except he's making a lot more money than you are.
Yeah, $25 million a year.
Yeah.
But I did some joint programming with KPFT and Houston Media Source on World AIDS Day. I was responsible for 4 hours of programming over at Houston Media Source, and I want to thank the staff over there for giving me that opportunity. That's kind of an annual responsibility that I have. And
you also did election coverage here.
I did election coverage here with the programmer that does the new Capitol show.
He's great. He's wonderful. He is really a good, you know, it's another great program.
He's as Pacifica as you get.
Well, when he first came on the air, I wasn't so sure about him. But then again,
I've had to pull him aside and talk about some traditional stuff and some fundraising things, ideas that he had that just were in violation of the principle. But he's a fast learner. He's very smart. He's very intelligent. He knows his economics very well. I'm learning things about economics, listening to, I actually listen to KPFT a lot, and I listen to Rush Limbaugh, and I listen to
I listen to 1070 a bit, too.
Yeah.
And they're not quite as bad, but, you know, maybe that's even worse because they're not so objectionable.
No, that's just it. But the conservative talk show radio people are the ones that cost the Republicans this election. It's anybody that understands media and how it works. I was listening to your political conversations earlier. What has happened is that their mendacity bubbled up. I mean, how did Robert Graves put it in I, Claudius, and all the things that lurk in the mud?
Well, crawl
out and be seen.
The conservative talk show was a reflection of what the Republicans were doing.
Yeah.
They weren't really, you know, I mean, they lost their conservatism. They just threw away all the money that we, you know, no longer have. And they didn't listen to the people. And they ruled like they won, like, by 90%, when in reality they won by, you know,
very, very narrow margins. This country is really very close to being more balanced. I listened to that part of the conversation. And I agree with some of what your commentator had to say about the prospects for 2 years.
Well, the reality is the Democrats have to govern. They have to do their job.
They don't have the numbers to govern, Jack. Fact of the matter is, it's with the presidential veto laying there, it's his fault or their fault. And that's a very careful game to play with media. Everybody needs to take time out and go read a little Marshall McLuhan so they know what they're doing. And all that. I had the big news story since I've been here on Logo.
Mm-hmm.
That's new.
Yes, which we don't get here in Houston.
We don't get here in Houston, but it's available on the Internet, and I've got it on my website. My new website is theprisonshow.org, and you can link off of that if you've got high speed, and you can get that story. I've got a big thing for me coming up on the 10th. I go to Huntsville for a major preaching engagement at the Huntsville Unitarian Fellowship. Get to pay my dues to Unitarians up there and talk about restorative justice. And then on the 11th at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center, I am screening that Logo piece. So if you haven't been able to download it on your computer, I have it on CD or DVD, I guess, on DVD. And so we will play that. It's only about 12 minutes. But it's a very good encapsulated telling of the murder of Paul Broussard and the investigation that resulted in the charging of the Woodlands 10 and my emerging and developing relationship with the Woodlands 10. And then I will follow that story with Aaron Sachs, a documentary filmmaker's interview with John Bice in prison. And that's going to be a very interesting evening. It's going to make some people very uncomfortable, and all of that will be followed, of course, by a pretty lively, we hope, discussion.
But let's explain what the Woodlands 10 is.
1991, I got a call at 3 o'clock in the morning from Steve Little, and Steve Little had been our champion in the boycott of Randall's. And he got a large settlement from Randall's, and he bought a home in Montrose. And he was awakened in the middle of the night with gay bashing going on a block away from his house, and he went down. And that happened at about 2 o'clock, and then about 3 o'clock he went home and called me and said the emergency team was not transporting the assaulted party, Paul Broussard, because he was a gay man in hot pants and they assumed that he had AIDS and they didn't want to touch him. And so I called the dispatcher and asked the dispatcher to meet me there, and I went to the scene, and by the time I got there, the dispatcher had got on the radio and they transported him, and he was lucid and conversational when he left the Twit parking lot, actually. And so I assumed that he went to Bentaub Hospital, but no, they carried him to St. Joseph's Hospital, which didn't even have a doctor on duty. And so he was beaten and stabbed at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the hospital emergency room records indicated that they took his vital signs at 4:47.
Oh, Jesus.
So Paul, had he received adequate emergency care, would be alive. That does not absolve his assailants. And the police said, Mr. Hill, we're not going to solve this case. And I said, I had heard that, Jack and Jennifer, so many times.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to so many crime scenes. Well, we ain't going to solve this one. We ain't got nothing to investigate. And this is just one more time that I'd heard that, and I said, as a matter of fact, we are going to solve this case. You're not going to solve it, but I can. And the following weekend, I put 4,000 people at the corner of Westheimer and Montrose, and Dale Brown, the infamous Dale Brown of Special Ops, said, Captain Brown said, when do you want to block traffic? I said, I want you to block traffic until I block the street. I want people caught in this demonstration in cards cursing out of their windows.
Around 10 p.m.
Makes a better story. Exactly 10 p.m. But Dale did not divert the traffic at all. It just continued. And then all of a sudden we just came out in the middle of the street with the television cameras following and blocked the traffic. And there were people hollering at us out the windows of their cars. But see, that makes a better story. And we were the lead story on all three network stations, and that's all we had then. We were the front page of the Houston Post, Rest Its Soul, and the Houston Chronicle the next day. And we kept that level of notoriety. Actually, Paul Broussard was the first nationally discussed news media story about a gay bashing. I mean, that's long before anything else. And that's because I know how to manipulate the media, shamelessly sometimes. And I pulled out all my stops. I called
right, it also brought in the Project Vice Versa.
Well, that was just another way to make a news story. I went to the Vice Squad. I went to the Vice Squad and said, look, do you all know how much violence there is against gay people in Montrose? No. And I said, well, put me some undercover officers out there looking like gay people. Well, that got me CBS Evening News and Ted Koppel.
And New York Times.
Right, and New York Times. I mean, I was creating a story. One of my friends, bless her heart, let's see, can I disclose? No. Susan Bardwell, who was writing for the Post at the time, she was their police reporter. She would later be a long police reporter for the Chronicle. She said that she'd work with me half the day on the story because she had sympathetic ear and she's looking for a good story, and then she would finish the story, put it turn in her copy, and go home and turn on a television and see an entirely different story on a television station from the one that I had obviously spent half the day working on. And she said, how does he do this? How many rails are there? But the deal is I wanted to keep this at a very high level of publicity until someone came forward with some information. And a young woman walked up to Professor Carl Reinhart, openly gay professor at the University of Houston. Dr. Reinhart, I know one of the guys that killed that banker. And he said, well, you need to call Ray Hill. And he gave her my telephone number, and she called me. I talked to her 2 minutes. So obviously she knew what she talked about. And I said, no, hon, you need to call Crime Stoppers because the information you have will pay a handsome reward. Mm. So she called that number and identified one of them. We tracked him down. He was with his grandmother in New York until the heat blew over, and we had him arrested up there and brought to Houston by Detective Vacaris. I said, no, I'll have him brought down here. I said, no, you go get him. No, no, we don't have a budget for that. I said, don't worry, the mayor will sign the check, I promise you.
It was also an election year.
It was also an election year. And he said, I don't have time. I said, you'll find time. Why do you want me to do that? And I said, because when that plane lands in Houston, I want the name of his co-conspirators. What about his Fifth Amendment rights? I said, the identity of the people with him that night have nothing to do with his Fifth Amendment rights. Don't you read the Constitution? Don't they teach you anything in the police academy? So we went and got him, and when he came back, we had 9 other names. 2 days later, we did the roundup, and with Fred Pye's assistance, I did a 17-camera news conference at the back of Houston Police Station while all of the Woodlands 10 were running behind me. And then I used influence I had with the judge and the prosecutor, everybody that touched Paul Broussard except the informant would go to prison. The rest of them would get probation. That was my rules. All of them were under the law of parties equally responsible, but I have a better sense of fairness than the state of Texas. You're just along for the ride and you didn't hurt anybody, you could have probation. 5 went to prison, 5 got probation, 2 violated, including my informant. And so 7 went to prison. And then it occurred to me, if we're sending people to Texas prison for crime of prejudice, and we don't do something else, the institution is far more homophobic than McCullough High School in the Woodlands. Uh-huh. So we're going to be sending mad dogs to prison, and we're going to get rattlesnakes back.
So true.
So I decided that I would communicate with them. I didn't write them. I just go on the radio. I got the prison show, and I said, I want this fellow John Bice to write me. And so a friend of his who listened to the program every week said, a friend of mine wants you to write him. Who is he? And he said, Ray Hill. Had SOB sent me to prison. Why the hell would I write him? I said, you got Ray all wrong. So finally John wrote me a what the hell do you want letter. And I answered back, and I said, well, you know, you got 45 years. It's not going to be easy for a 17-year-old to do 45 years. And I know a lot about prisons. I can help you make it easier. I think you need to get to know me, and I'd like to get to know you. We haven't met in this process. And so we started corresponding. Someday, when I retire from active involvement in the prison show, as I have retired from active involvement in the gay and lesbian community, and y'all notice I don't go to meetings anymore.
I noticed that.
I show up for my picture being taken, and I'm available to advise people in positions of responsibility, but I don't care what the decision is. I'm not involved. John Bice will take my place on the prison show. And there's a message in that. A message about forgiveness and restoration, and a message about a prison system and a criminal justice system that does its job better than it has been doing. And that is my work for the next 5 years, is to create a movement for criminal justice reform, something else for me to retire from. And I've got a plan. I've got this documentary that was recently in the newspapers. Lovely article with 3 pictures. I've never seen an article with 3 pictures. 3 pictures, and we did a screening of that. That's good. That should be finished by spring. I've got a major article coming out in the publication with the largest circulation in the world. Middle class, middle American kind of stuff, an audience that I would never be able to reach. And when that is over, I'm going to get an agent, and I am going to tour this country talking about criminal justice reform and restorative justice for a year.
That's great.
And then the documentary for The Woodlands 10 and I will be out, and I'm going to tour this country for another year. And then in 2009, I'm going to call a national conference, which will be the launching of a political movement to reform the criminal justice system. I'm still ambitious. I still have the know-how. I want those of you older members of the audience to imagine what we thought about queers in the 1970s. Think about it, just a minute. Early 70s. What did America, what did Houston, what did Texas think about homosexual men and lesbians and transgendered people 30 years ago? What do they think about them now? You're welcome. I didn't do all of that work, but I was in the room where it was planned.
Can I thank you anyway?
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks.
You also do When to Get Out of the Room, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a wonderful, there was a wonderful quote from Katharine Hepburn. I always enjoyed the party, but I never knew when to leave.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's good to remember little Kate. She was homophobic, but she had a good line once in a while. She wasn't quite Molly Adams.
And the prison program is on when?
Friday nights, beginning at 9 o'clock. We now are no longer run after 11 o'clock any night. So you'll be able to get your rest before going to work, if you work on Saturdays, or going to play Saturdays. Friday night on radio station KPFT Houston at 9 o'clock on Fridays. And you can tell that I enjoy doing that radio show.
Yes.
I enjoy doing this radio show.
Well, Ray, I appreciate you coming by and
thank you
keeping us up to date.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for keeping this. Actually, this very radio program used to be called Wildenstein, and I did it myself for many years. And Jack was sitting over in the wings.
Until they canceled it.
Until they canceled it, and then he was revolted.
So we started our own revolution.
But he's been faithful to the purpose. And the staff here, young people coming in with fresh ideas and excitement. And J.D., I mean, God, his understanding of music is just a gold mine. And thank you for keeping the faith with this programming. And thank the audience. Some of you have been with us all those years.
Well, Ray, thank you for coming by. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
think about it.
And that was Jill Sobule, best known for her song, I Kissed a Girl. And this was I Saw a Cop. And it's from By B.I. The People in 2003. You're listening to Queer Voices. Next up, News Wrap.
This is Queer Voices.
We're married in London, but not in New York. Spain says we're kosher, the States say we're pork. We went in Toronto, the judge said amen. And when we got home, we were single again. It's hard being married and living in sin. Sometimes I'm not sure just which state I am in. Thank God I'm not Catholic. I'd be a mess trying to figure out what to confess. Partnered for life. But back in America, land of the free, I'm a threat to the national security. If I were a frog, here's what I would say. It's hard being green, it's hard being gay. But love has no color, hearts have no sex, so love where you can and screw all the rest. Thank you very much.
That was a live-in performance ditty by Janice Ian about being married in London and elsewhere, which can be found at www.janiceian.com. The story of another lesbian who's famous and infamous for her words is coming up later in the program, along with a tribute to one of history's gay greats and a preview of a new film by an out director dramatizing the multidimensional facets of the global AIDS crisis.
Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Lebanon, Ohio, a longtime This Way Out listener and donor. In memory of my mother, Mabel Simmons, I'm issuing a matching challenge to supporters of this volunteer-driven nonprofit operation. Please visit thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air will now be worth twice as much. You'll also get a tax deduction if you're in the United States, and you'll find some unique holiday gifts there too. Again, please log on to thiswayout.org. We'll all be very thankful.
There's no time to lose. This offer ends December 31st.
Leonardo da Vinci, Renaissance man, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Leonardo da Vinci was born in Italy in 1452. By age 14, his extraordinary talents as a painter were undeniable. He went on to become one of the greatest painters of the Italian Renaissance, creating such masterpieces as the Madonna of the Rocks and the Last Supper fresco. Over the course of his life, Leonardo was devoted to a number of attractive young men. His drawings of his pupil, Giacomo Caprotti, spanned 20 years. Later, he took an interest in a young aristocrat named Francesco Melzi, who remained by his side until Leonardo's death in 1519. He left behind over 8,000 pages of mere scripted inventions, scientific sketches, and architectural designs. Although some were impractical at the time, others were precursors to the modern-day bicycle and helicopter. His drawings revealed that not only was he the consummate Renaissance artist, but a prolific innovator and scientific genius. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios of WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Tom Miller.
I'm Margaret Cho.
Hello, this is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm comedian Bob Smith.
Hi, I'm Kate Quinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
Hi, I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, I'm Scott Thompson.
Hi, I'm David Sedaris.
Hi, this is Jeff Straker.
Hi, this is Chastity Bono, and you're listening to
This Way Out.
This Way Out?
This Way Out.
The International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
December 1st marked yet another World AIDS Day in the 25th year since the disease was first identified. Clarion calls rose from every corner of the globe, warning of the continuing threat posed by the pandemic. As always, the watchwords were education, testing, and safe sex, with calls for better access to expensive antiretroviral drugs for the tens of millions of people with HIV/AIDS in impoverished areas. Infection rates continue their relentless rise from Asia and Africa, where international experts place the epidemic's epicenters, to Eastern Europe, where official acknowledgement is just catching up, to the gay metropolises of the West, where a new generation of gay men seems to be willfully ignorant of the horrors their predecessors faced in the first several years of the disease. 25 million people have died since those early days, and 40 million are currently estimated to be infected worldwide. Three stories depicting the international AIDS crisis are the meat of Three Needles, a unique and moving film that This Way Out's Steve Pride says informs, enlightens, and, thanks to remarkable performances, entertains. A small indie picture on such a serious subject could easily get lost amid all the big-budget holiday openings, but Steve thinks that would be a shame. He hopes to convince you with this preview and a conversation with out gay Canadian filmmaker Tom Fitzgerald.
So beautiful.
It's a little spooky.
It was talking.
You already supply AZT to your employees.
What else could I do?
Well, you could extend your charity to the community through the mission.
Isn't a charity plan? A quarter of my payroll carries the virus. Soon it's going to be half.
What about their families?
Financing the survival of Africa would bankrupt me in a day.
Three Needles is a trilogy of stories that relate to each other only through the circumstance of a worldwide plague. In South Africa, a nun makes a personal sacrifice for the benefit of an impoverished village. In rural China, a black market operative posing as a government bloodmobile worker jeopardizes an entire town. And in Montreal, an HIV-positive porn actor schemes to pass his mandatory blood test. It has an all-star cast that includes Stalker Channing, Olympia Dukakis, Lucy Liu, Sandra Oh, Chloe Sevigny, and Sean Ashmore. And it was written and directed by out-gay Canadian filmmaker Tom Fitzgerald, best known for The Hanging Garden, Beefcake, and The Event. Three Needles is easily his most ambitious work. And according to him, it was also a learning experience.
A lot of my education in researching the film was about the wide variety of different ways that HIV is spread. It was through talking to actual missionaries that I learned of the recycling of needles, which is so prevalent in parts of Africa, because people there aren't consumers. They're used to reclaiming and reusing everything that they possibly have as resources. And in South Africa, I went to the clinic and learned firsthand about the rape of children, where the myth tells people that a virgin has special healing powers. And I'd read about it, but I wanted to go to the clinic and see what the real truth was. And then they confirmed that, yes, this is something that does happen, and it's so prevalent that the university there suggests that it's more than half of children at this point are being raped before they're out of elementary school. I didn't actually get to do research in China. A filmmaker needs a host producer to work in China, and I asked 14 different producers, but none of them were willing to submit the script to the censorship board. This was 3+ years ago, and AIDS was only just acknowledged in China at that time. It was a very controversial and scary issue.
One surprise in Three Needles is that it focuses primarily on heterosexual characters.
In the big picture of AIDS, gay men make up a tiny fraction of people with AIDS. There is no one face of AIDS. From culture to culture, from Africa to Asia to North America, it's unrecognizable. I think that must be part of the reason why we don't come together to fight it. That's a question that plagued me. Why, when we all have a common enemy in this virus, has it only caused us to point fingers, lay blame, become enraged? And I think it's because we don't recognize AIDS from place to place. It's a different monster in every village.
In Tom Fitzgerald's last film, The Event, the monster was in a very different village. That film was about AIDS and the gay community in New York's fashionable Chelsea district.
I felt when I was making The Event that I was not making a gay film. I felt like this was a story I was making for my mom and for all the other moms out there in New Jersey. Gay people knew that story inside out and backwards. This was not going to be something enlightening to us. So with Three Needles, though, I think it's actually a film that gay people do respond to particularly. And I think it's partly because my journey to try and redefine this ghost in my life, I think also is important to other gay men. The idea of looking at AIDS from a very different perspective than we have been for so long is kind of a release in a lot of ways.
Since it was first officially recognized on June 5th, 1981, it's estimated that AIDS has killed more than 25 million people. And while the next wave of HIV/AIDS is spreading most rapidly among heterosexuals in places like Nigeria, Ethiopia, Russia, India, and China, gay men must remain vocal and vigilant.
I think gay men understand what it feels like to be terrorized and disempowered by this disease. Gay men understand what it's like to stand up and fight, to fight politically, to fight socially, and I'll tell you, that's where we failed in Africa. And you know where we've never moved on from our ideas of AIDS being a gay disease is in our prevention methods. The prevention methods today are the same ones that grew out of the raging debate between gay men and political conservatives in the 80s. And gay men shouted condoms, condoms, and political conservatives shouted abstinence, faithfulness. Well, you know what? Those things are what we can do to prevent AIDS. Two gay men in San Francisco can negotiate the use of a condom. Everyone I met in South Africa understood that they should condomize it. They had some kind of slogan they'd been taught. They understood a condom would protect them, but they sure as hell didn't have any condoms. We went over there and taught them condoms would keep them safe, but we have utterly failed to provide the condoms to the people of Africa. I believe on average each year there are 3 condoms for every person in Africa. Well, that's not a lot of sex. And where we shot our film in South Africa, in this rural region, women were taught never to look in a man's eye directly, that it wasn't her place. They were taught never to hold her head higher than a man's. If she encountered a man shorter than her, she was to crouch and slouch. Men sit on chairs and women sit on the floor. If you can't look your husband in the eye, you certainly can't tell if he's been faithful to you. So our ideas of AIDS prevention have nothing to do with the people of Africa, and they haven't helped at all. We need to treat AIDS societally. The status of women and the status of children has to be addressed in a broad way. A woman has to be able to say no to sex if she's going to choose abstinence or faithfulness in the first place.
And what does Tom Fitzgerald hope audiences will take away from his film?
The importance of getting beyond our own experience and point of view about this pandemic, because it's growing. I really am hard-pressed to think of how many things are more important to us as a species to combat, to address. But we are very limited by the fact that we're fighting it in isolation, that the methods that work here aren't going to work in Africa, that things that work in Africa aren't going to work in Asia. We need to step outside. It's very difficult for humans to step outside their own point of view. It's one of the great limitations and, I suppose, beauties of being human. But if we're going to be able to defeat this virus before it defeats us, we are going to have to somehow understand what it's like to be somebody else. One of the few things that a movie can do is introduce you to somebody else's point of view.
This has been a conversation with out gay director Tom Fitzgerald. Three Needles is being distributed in the U.S. by Wolf Releasing. More info about the film can be found at 3-needles.com and, as always, at prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
I saw fools with roses and eyes like Moses. It's all too familiar. Enough to kill you. I saw Copenhagen cages.
down the wise man.
Gertrude Stein, Out Lesbian Across the Centuries, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Gertrude Stein was born in Pennsylvania in 1874. As a young woman, she discovered a passion for writing and moved to Paris. Her books were always controversial, but she became famous in light of her persona, a mannish avant-garde intellectual. In 1907, she met Alice B. Toklas, who would become her lifetime companion. Since Gertrude was an avid arts patron, their home became a popular hangout for famous artists and writers, such as Picasso and Hemingway. She would lead lofty discussion about art while Alice cooked and kept house. In the 30s, they traveled to America to promote one of Gertrude's books as the world's most famous lesbian couple. The radiance of their 39-year relationship was captured in Gertrude's written word. How prettily we swim, not in water, not on land, but in love. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios of WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Candace Gingrich.
She's a seasoned women's music icon.
I know I'm not your therapist.
He's a polished young rookie making waves in the Big Apple. Hi, I'm Chris Wilson.
I'm J.D. Doyle, and they are just two of a talented crop of GLBT musicians who present on the Audiophile 2006 Year in Review.
Coming the last week of December here on This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Tanya Kane Perry, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Steve Pride, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Tom Miller and Candace Gingrich contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle. Rick Kirk performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. Remember, your support is worth twice as much to us until the end of the year, and you can choose from some special CD thank you gifts too. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WYEP Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, CFUR, Prince George, British Columbia, KZSC, Santa Cruz, California, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Let's all stay tuned.
And, of course, this community radio station is KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. And remember that you can listen to us on the web at www.kpft.org. The shows are archived for 60 days, so you can download them and listen to them again or save them and listen to them later. And that's a really nifty thing. I love technology.
You
when do? It works.
When it works. Sometimes we kind of, like earlier I said, news wrap, but we had already played news wrap, and that was, of course, the rest of This Way Out.
That was not a technology problem.
No, that was... Well, yes, it was.
have you tried to download one of our archives? It's interesting. It has play and download. Well, the download plays it. And
right.
yes,
they
right.
got it backwards.
That's kind of the way it works.
Oh.
Like I had this CD that I downloaded, and it played. And then once it finished playing, it was complete. The download was complete. And that is going to be something that we're going to have on the radio show next week.
Really? What's that?
Well, it is an incredible speech by Leslie Feinberg. And we'll, as we close out, we'll give more details about that. But it's something that I really hope people will tune in for because it is pretty extraordinary. I just thought, oh, it's a speech from a conference, but even though I'm a big fan of Leslie Feinberg. And then I was listening to it, and I was just mesmerized. I just sat and listened to the whole thing while it was downloading.
Right. Sometimes speeches can be rather boring on the radio or television, just like I thought the Al Gore movie about the environment was going to be really boring, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was a really good documentary.
Well, if you've ever sat and listened to Noam Chomsky, which...
You do a lot on Amy's show.
Yeah, well, whenever I hear that voice, it's like I'm going to sit and listen to it. And it's kind of like that. It is that good of a speech that good of a message. So do we have other things coming up this week that we need to let folks know about?
I'd like to remind everybody about the Houston GLBT Political Caucus General Meeting, which is at 7 p.m. Wednesday night at 3400 Montrose, Suite 207. Kristen Mack will be there, and she's speaking. And if you don't know who Kristen is, she is the political writer with the Houston Chronicle and a good friend of our community.
And you don't have to be a member of the caucus to attend. And you can come as often as you like and not be a member, but certainly your membership is welcome.
Exactly.
And it's a good chance to get to know some people and find out about some volunteer opportunities, which is also a great way to make friends and to do something.
Yeah, if you want to get involved, you can always go to our website at www.hglbtpc.org and see what our list of events are. You know, we try to keep the website up and keep it current for you so you can get involved and stay involved. Also, can't miss Thursday night at 209 West Drew at Taft, the GLBT Political Caucus PACT is having a fundraiser. It begins at
7 p.m.
And come and join us. There'll be several people will be there. Anise Parker and Sue Lovell will be there. We'll be speaking and with some other guests.
Ernie Coleman and Ellen Cohen.
Yes, we'll be there. And come and if you haven't had a chance to meet them, our elected representative, come and meet them. It's a chance to do so, and of course, please bring a check. The Caucus PAC does a lot of good work. We have a lot to do this next year because it is city elections coming up, and we are the instrument of your will as far as our community in this city. So please be part of the caucus, be part of the Caucus PAC by contributing.
And the Bayou City Women's Chorus has another performance tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Bering. I think it's 7 p.m. Somebody will correct me if I'm incorrect. And they also will be again singing on Thursday night. So there's a lot of things. I mean, the beginning of this month really just is like, oh my gosh. I'm looking at my calendar and there's like something. When am I going to sleep? Because there's just so many things.
And I'm sure there's lots of Christmas parties going on.
Lots of Christmas parties.
Yeah, or something that maybe you wouldn't care to go to for various reasons.
Yeah, but I want to be invited.
Well.
Well, what's going on next week?
Next week on the show?
Well, on the show. Well, what's going on next week? Whatever you want to talk about.
I was
going
to say, well, let me look at my appointment book. Well, Jennifer, you have something.
Yes, I do. I'm going to interview James Robinson and a guest on the issues concerning HIV and AIDS in the black community.
And what's James Robertson's expertise?
James is president of the Black Dems and also liaison to the black community in city government.
Oh, excellent.
But one of the things, I've been to several of their meetings myself, and there's a big effort on the part of the black community to get the word out and inform their community about AIDS in their own community, which is killing more black men and women. A whole generation could be wiped out unless something is done now.
Yeah, it's something that we just have to constantly remind folks about use prevention methods for safer sex, get tested, know your status, do what you need to do to take care of yourself, whether you're negative or positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and of course we'll have the internationally syndicated program This Way Out on. And that powerful speech by Leslie Feinberg. She's the author of Stone Butch Blues and Transgender Warriors.
I read that. That was a good book.
Oh, both of those. Excellent. I highly recommend both of them. Ray was talking about the way it used to be back like in the 50s. Well, Stone Butch Blues talks about that, about coming out and living in a working class community and some of the things that people had to endure. And she talks about the intertwining, the myriad of issues affecting anyone who transgresses the acceptable gender role, issues of feminism, of race, just how all of that's connected and is not to be missed. And that'll be
I'll be interested in hearing that.
Yeah, that'll be on Queer Voices next week.
And then J.D. is doing two Christmas specials of queer music.
Yeah, he won't be with us next week, but on the 18th and Christmas Day, there will be hour-long specials of gay Christmas or holiday music. So who knew that there was even that much?
Oh, there is.
Well,
JD
knew. That's who. And we'll thank our guests that were on tonight, who were
of course Ray Hill,
and David Elliott,
and Colleen Fisher and Kelly. I'm blanking out on her name.
Thank you, Kelly, and apologize
Kelly
for forgetting your last name.
Bennett.
Ah, very good.
Bennett, from the Bayou City Performing Arts, for being with us here tonight. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned for the World Village Cafe up next, and join us next week on Monday starting at 8 p.m. Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Polensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Listen to Neil Katyal on the next Border Crossing show on December 6th at 10 p.m. In June 2006, Neil Katyal successfully argued the Hamdan v. Rumsfeld case in the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of Salim Ahmed Hamdan, one-time car driver to Osama bin Laden. In a landmark decision, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated the system set up by President Bush to try accused war criminals at Guantanamo Bay. The court's 5-3 vote decision is one of the most important rulings in the history of executive power. Join us on Border Crossings on December 6th at 10 p.m. for a discussion with Mr. Katyal about the Hamdan trial, the Military Commissions Act, the Geneva Conventions, and other important topics. If you have any questions for Mr. Katyal, please send them to the Border Crossings Show at bcrossings@yahoo.com. This is 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
KPFT will preempt its programming Tuesday, December 5th for a special live gavel-to-gavel broadcast of the United States Senate Armed Services full committee hearing on the nomination of Robert Gates to be Secretary of Defense. Gates is President Bush's choice to replace Donald Rumsfeld and has been president of Texas A&M University, but has a long history of serving under five presidents in various national security and intelligence positions, including Director of Central Intelligence from 1991 to 1992. 1993. His nomination hearings in 91 were very controversial due to sharp testimony by CIA analysts on his reputation for pressuring them to manipulate and slant intelligence, and his suspect role in the Iran-Contra scandal. Again, the Gates nomination hearings happen Tuesday, December 5th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Our regular programming will return the following week. This is KPFT Houston.
KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is the World Village Cafe.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.